taken under advisement. Thank you very much to both parties. Morning. 12-10-15, Venson versus Altamirano.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
I'm Irene Dimkar, and I represent the plaintiff, Jeremy Venson. Jeremy was an 18-year-old African-American man, 11 a.m. He's on the way to his girlfriend's house. His mother had given him $50 because he took care of his siblings. She wanted him to have some money on the date. He stopped at a corner store to buy iced tea. A police car passed him by and then backed up, and then three police officers jumped out, grabbed him, threw him against the car, cuffed him, said, "What's going on? Where's the shit?" And they went into his pockets, into his pants, into his genital area, his buttocks area. They took off his shoes, pulled off his socks, threw the socks into the street.
Now, when you argue, don't you have to argue the evidence that is most favorable to the verdict? Your view, there isn't lots of evidence in the record that supports your view, but there's lots of evidence that supports the verdict.
Your Honor, I just wanted to make a point that in my entire brief, I do accept their version, and their version is very different than the plaintiff's version. I can switch gears. The question here is whether there was probable cause for an arrest. It's not whether there was reasonable suspicion
for a stop, too.
Right.
We have to concern ourselves with that.
Right. There are two seizures here. There's a based on the police decision to arrest him for solicitation of unlawful business. A few minutes later, another seizure based on police decision to arrest him for possession of controlled substance. Separated by minutes, but they need to be analyzed separately. And in their brief, the defense fails to address the issue of whether defendants had probable cause to arrest for solicitation of unlawful business.
Did he present any evidence that it would be improbable, if not impossible, to hear someone yelling rocks, rocks, rocks from 300-plus feet away? I guess I'm wondering on what basis we as appellate judges could say that the jury couldn't credit the officer's testimony on that point.
Well, we have... Given that, of course, the testimony, we do have the pictures, we do have the map.
Yeah,
it's
but
a
do,
long
do you have, I don't know, an audiologist or someone who could say that the human ear is not capable of doing that? Or I know, as you argue, it seems unlikely, but did you show at trial that it could not have happened?
We did not bring an expert. We didn't show that it was impossible, but
so,
certainly...
So you're asking us to evaluate it as the jury was asked to evaluate it.
Well, I'm asking the court to look at the map. I'm asking the court to look at the picture. If it's exceedingly improbable,
did you demonstrate that the photograph captures it as a human eye would capture it, that this is scientifically certain, that it's exactly as you say it is?
It was not objected to by the defendant. And we did stage it so that Jeremy Benson was standing where they say he was. They said they saw his mouth moving, and they could hear him say the words rocks, rocks. Certainly, you know, I guess if there's a continuum. If somebody's a mile away from somebody, I think the court would have problem.
If he said in Chicago he heard somebody in Indianapolis yelling something, I guess we could take notice that couldn't happen. But
and in this case, we've got it's a football field length. It's a long distance. Even if he is screaming, they couldn't have made out the words. And
I understand it. There was a large apartment building, for instance, located near to where he was standing. Could he have been yelling rocks loudly so that people in the building might hear him? That might be a plausible inference. There are many, many inferences are plausible.
And do sounds reverberate off buildings at times in an environment? Have you ever been in a stadium where the fans were just dead silent and the team at the other end of the field is doing things that can be heard?
Well, I guess our point was that Jeremy was faced the other way. There's no reason for him to be screaming. Now, that's our motion for judgment as a matter of law based on exceedingly improbable.
Physically impossible. And see, that's the thing we're grappling with. We don't have any specific testimony that it was physically impossible. And so basically you're asking us to second-guess the jury.
I'm asking you to look at the pictures and make a determination mm-hmm. that this was a distance that it would be exceedingly improbable, given everything else, too, that came in.
And we're saying
cannot do that.
Right.
Well, we've also asked the court for de novo review of the denial of motion for judgment as a matter of law, that there was no probable cause to seize Jeremy for solicitation of unlawful business. Now, the defense says that there was an investigatory stop, but that was not an issue in the trial, and that's very important to note. Defendants never made it an issue in the trial that this was an investigative stop. The jury was never instructed on investigative stop. They were never instructed on a reasonable suspicion. So when the trial judge says, well, maybe they thought it was an investigative stop, there's no way the jury could have because they were not instructed as to that. Now, the judge did say plaintiff may be correct. They're merely yelling rocks may be insufficient for probable cause. And then he says, I don't need to wade into that area, referring to People versus Grant, where this matter is before the Illinois Supreme Court now, where the intermediate court has said that just simply saying dro-dro in a public way is not sufficient for probable cause. So the judge never dealt with the probable cause issue. The defense doesn't deal with the probable cause issue. But at trial, it was a probable cause issue. It was probable cause for an arrest, followed by probable cause for arrest. Those were the issues. There was nothing about investigative stop. There's nothing that the jury heard about investigative stop or reasonable suspicion. And so the trial court, in its decision, had to deal with the probable cause issue because that's what the jury dealt with. And there's a problem with the facts. The defendants contended that there's a stop, but they testified that as soon as they turned onto 13th Street going the wrong way, they decided they were going to detain him. They decided that they were going to arrest him. And then, of course, once they order him to stop, he's not free to go. So we've got the Florida versus Bostic. You know, three police officers jump out of the car. They say, hey, you come here. He is not going to leave. He's not free to leave. That is an arrest. So we're asking for a de novo review of the denial of motion for summary judgment as a matter of law, that there was no probable cause for the seizure of Jeremy for solicitation of unlawful business, which was defined at trial as knowingly offers for sale any substance containing cocaine. There are no customers, no exchange of drugs or money, no sale. The only evidence at all for the solicitation of unlawful business before they seize him is their saying that he said rocks. So that's why that becomes an important issue. But even if assuming they heard rocks, we're saying that that's not enough for probable cause to seize him.
Well, let me just say that yelling rocks could very well suffice as a basis to arrest, given the obvious and well-known connection between rocks and crack cocaine. And look, it's highly unlikely that he was a lapidary, for instance. You know, I mean, and once the jury, you know, believes that evidence, that's what we're left with.
I'm saying that only using the words rocks, I would ask this court to look at what the Illinois appellate court has determined, which is that is not enough for probable cause. And as I said, it's before the Illinois Supreme Court at this point. I would like to, if I could, turn to expert testimony. Plaintiffs asked for a review de novo of district court's failure to make a determination that the defendant police officers were testifying as experts without complying with Rule 702 and federal rules regarding notice and disclosure. A district court said that it didn't have to make a determination as to whether there was an expert because the testimony was harmless. We contend the determination had to be made and the testimony was not harmless. These three officers were not FBI agents. They were not narcotics agents. They were garden variety officers. And each one gave expert testimony over numerous objections by myself as plaintiff's attorney. Jania said a person who has narcotics is selling it. person who's selling it has been previously arrested. Person's been previously arrested, knows the more narcotics he has, the worse it is for him. So a seller's going to have a small amount on him. Because a small amount was found on the ground behind plaintiff, there's an inescapable conclusion that he was selling, that he was previously arrested, and he's savvy enough not to have more than a small amount on him. One of the last questions the defense counsel asked Jania was, you're not talking about this specific situation. You're just saying, based on your experience. And that's how the defense kept on getting this in, based on your experience, whether it was relevant to what was, you know, before the court or not.
Well, isn't the test to determine whether there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause part is a totality of circumstances test, and in that totality of circumstances, one of the factors that's considered is the experience of the officer. And so, therefore, that testimony was relevant and was admissible because they should be given the opportunity to testify about their experience. I mean, our case law says that.
Well, I think that they have to lay some foundation for it. I'm saying that they had to give notice and there had to be disclosure, but there at least had to be
that's if they were being called as experts. That's not what the situation here. They weren't being called as experts. They were testifying with respect to their experience on the street, and that led into, I mean, that's part of what we look at when we look at probable cause or reasonable suspicion. That's part of the circumstances.
Well, I'd ask the court to...
And also the objection that was made was not that there was no foundation. It was that the testimony was overly broad and everything. None of that was preserved, really, except for Jania.
For Jania, there was an objection.
Yes.
And then for Altamirano, was that there was no foundation. For Altamirano, 7 objections were made. For O'Keefe, it was the speculation overbroad. And I would ask the court...
But a Rule 702 objection,
right.
And that was not done with... except for Jania.
Right.
But look, it's permissible to ask officers what they know about drug dealer behavior based on their own experience, because it bears on how they perceived his behavior on the day of his arrest. And it informs the reasonable suspicion and probable cause analysis.
I would ask this court to look at its decision. I know I've gone to my rebuttal time, so I wanted to wrap up this portion.
Sure.
I would ask the court to look at Tribble, where the court said summarizing experiences, drawing conclusions from events outside the event being tried, the court has to make a determination whether the person testifying is an expert.
Tribble was not about whether an officer on the scene could draw inferences that would cause that officer to conclude the probable cause existed. Very different situation.
Well, then I asked the court to look at Orieta, where there are two types of officers, two federal narcotics agents testified. One said that baggies with corners cut off is the way dealers usually package cocaine for resale. This court said that's testifying as an expert. The other agent testified that when I came to the scene, I saw another car and thought there might be a counter surveillance. Court said that is not. This court said that's not expert testimony because you're relating it to the scene. And here we have the officers who are, first of all, they're not narcotics agents.
Every street officer deals with this on a daily basis.
But they're testifying as to other events. They're talking about other events. In fact, two of those three officers said that I'm not even talking about what we're doing here. I'm talking about in my experience. So if you preface it by in my experience, it seems the officers get to say anything they want. And I would like to return for rebuttal, so I will quit at this point. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hubert?
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Justin Hubert for the City of Chicago and the defendant officers.
Could you start off by telling us what it was that caused the state court judge to find a lack of probable cause?
Well, Your Honor, to be honest, the state court judge did not state his reasons on the record. He simply heard Officer Altamirano's testimony about what had occurred at the time of the arrest and at the end said no probable cause, charge dismissed, and then asked the prosecution whether it wanted to continue with the misdemeanor charge of solicitation at that time. And at that time, it was nolle prost by the prosecution, and that's what occurred in the state court.
Thank you.
Okay. So to begin, Your Honors, the district court here did not err by denying Benson judgment as a matter of law because the jury had ample support for its verdict. Judgment as a matter of law is appropriate only where no rational jury could have reached the same verdict as that reached below. But here, by crediting the officer's testimony, the jury plainly had ample support for its verdict that it reached. Nothing about the officer's account of the arrest was physically impossible, as Ms. Dimkar just admitted. There was nothing about it was against the laws of nature. Nothing was contradicted by documented objective evidence or internally inconsistent. And this was essentially a credibility contest between Mr. Benson and the officers, who presented contrary accounts of what occurred at the day of the arrest, and judging such credibility is specifically the province of the jury. And specifically here, Benson is not due judgment as a matter of law on the issue of probable cause. Now, on appeal, Mr. Benson asserts that there were two distinct periods of detention that must be separately analyzed as two separate arrests. But at trial, he pursued only a single false arrest claim, and the jury was only instructed on one false arrest charge or claim against the defendants. And usually the timing of an arrest during a police encounter is an issue of fact for the jury to determine.
Well, with respect to whether the initial encounter was a Terry stop or an arrest, Mr. Benson, argues that the jury was never instructed on Terry, so we have to analyze this as an arrest rather than an investigatory stop. So why don't you address that?
That's correct, Your Honor. The jury was not instructed on reasonable suspicion, but again, Mr. Benson didn't have a claim for an illegal stop. He had a claim for false arrest, and what the jury was instructed on was that probable cause means, was there a reason to believe, would a reasonable person believe at the time of the arrest that a crime had occurred if he was in the officer's position with the officer's knowledge? And the jury was instructed that if there was probable cause for either of the two charges against Mr. Benson at the time of the arrest, that the false arrest claim failed. So as the jury heard testimony that the officers initially decided to stop and detain Mr. Benson because they heard him yelling, "Rocks, rocks." Officer Johnny then testified that he saw Mr. Benson immediately drop suspect drugs, and at that point he recovered them and told the other officers that he had recovered suspect drugs. At that point, Officer Johnny had testified that Mr. Benson was placed into custody and searched. So the jury could easily have determined that the arrest occurred after the drugs were recovered and that there was probable cause for the possession charge. And if that's the case, then the false arrest charge failed as the jury was instructed. Therefore, it doesn't matter whether or not the jury was actually instructed on reasonable suspicion because there is a set of facts in the record here that supports the verdict. In addition, the court did not err here either by allowing the officers to provide expert testimony in this case. It should be noted at the outset that Mr. Benson raised an expert objection only to Officer Johnny's testimony. He did not object on expert grounds to either of the other officers' testimony, despite all of his litany of objections. When you look at the record, you will see that the word expert does not appear anywhere there regarding the other two officers. Nor does Federal Rule of Evidence Rule 702, there was nothing in the record to alert the trial judge to an expert objection as to the other two officers. But in any event, the officers' testimony was not expert testimony here, but rather testimony about their experience with other drug arrests that informed and supported their probable cause determination. And contrary to what Mr. Benson argues in his brief, we do not suggest here that probable cause should be judged on a subjective standard, but rather rely on this court's well-established case law holding that the objective determination of whether a reasonable officer in the arresting officer's position would have had probable cause based on the totality of circumstances, including the officer's experience and training. And for that reason, this evidence was highly relevant, and the only way practically for the jury to be put in the shoes of the arresting officers and to understand that experience, which informs the determination they were being asked to make from the position of a reasonable objective officer, was to allow the officers to tell them about that. And on that point, Tribble is readily distinguishable because the prosecutor's experience there with the reasons for the circuit court's dismissal of drug charges in low-weight drug cases simply was not at issue in that case in the way in which the officer's experience and training was at issue here in this probable cause case. And as far as Oriedo and the other criminal cases which have held that officers testifying about certain drug dealer behavior was expert testimony, none of those cases were civil cases in which a jury was asked to step into the shoes of a reasonable officer in the arresting officer's position. In those cases, we were dealing with criminal convictions and whether or not the officers testify as experts at a criminal trial. Briefly, Your Honor, I'll address one other issue which Mr. Benson has raised, and that is, Mr. Benson didn't address it in his his argument is Rule 60B3, so I won't address it unless the court has any questions. Otherwise, Your Honors, as to the other arguments that Mr. Benson has raised, we'll rest on our briefs, and we would respectfully ask that this court affirm the judgment below. Thank you, Your Honors.
You used all but a minute, but we'll give her 2 minutes.
Thank you. If you allow this pseudoscience where police officers can give testimony, have opinions about everything, then you're throwing away the objective test for probable cause. What's a young black man to do? If he sees the police and he walks away, that's indicative of guilt. If he stands there, then he's there for no apparent purpose, he's loitering, that's indicative of guilt. Here, if he's walking towards the police officers, that's indicative of guilt. What's he just supposed to do? Disappear into thin air? If you have a large amount of drugs,
the green bag that was dropped that had the drugs in it.
Your Honor,
so there was other conduct. I mean, I understand your position is that, you know, there was no reasonable suspicion, but if the arrest actually occurred after he dropped the bag, there was more there to the story.
Well, we're saying that the arrest occurred once they seized him, and they seized him when they said, hey, come over here, and got out of the car. He's not free to leave.
About that, but if we don't agree with you about that was the time of the seizure, then it's a problem. I mean, the jury was only instructed on probable cause for arrest, as counsel pointed out. And there was no request for any instruction on reasonable suspicion, was there?
No, there wasn't. The defense could have asked for reasonable suspicion, said, look, we come up to that standard. This was a stop, reasonable suspicion. They never did. So the jury dealt with probable cause for the arrest. I think this court has to deal with probable cause for arrest. And once you go into outside events and start talking about, you know, the experience of the officers and other cases, there's a problem. And when they say that the police officers use this in their calculus for probable cause, I do want to point out with Altamirano, he was talking about the 50 to 60 arrests from the time of Jeremy's arrest until the trial. That didn't add into this calculus of probable cause. There's a reason why there's determination of experts, there's a reason why there are Doebert hearings. And in general, I just have to say that this trial was not fair. If you look at the cumulative effect of everything that happened, and we've gone into some other issues in our brief, and I ask the court to take those into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.